Call the Planning Commission meeting to order. Commissioner Benz, would you lead us in the pledge, please?
Hand over heart and follow me in the pledge to our flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Could I have a roll call, please?
Commissioner Benz?
Present.
Commissioner Colmarino is absent. Commissioner Schmidt?
Present.
Commissioner Ward?
Here.
Commissioner Sturdivant?
Here.
Vice Chairperson Moreno?
Here.
And Chairperson Jack?
Here.
Six present, one absent.
Okay, thank you. Could I have a motion to approve the agenda, please?
Move approval of the agenda.
Second.
Could I have a roll call vote, please?
Yeah, who was it that did the first?
Oh, I'm sorry. Commissioner Benz made the motion, seconded by Vice Chair Moreno.
Okay. Commissioner Benz?
Yes.
Vice Chairperson Moreno?
Yes.
Commissioner Schmidt?
Yes.
Commissioner Ward?
Yes.
Commissioner Sturdivant?
Yes.
Chairperson Jack?
Yes.
Motion passes 6-0.
Okay. At this point, it's time for any public comment on anything that's not on tonight's agenda and that could be reasonably be expected to be brought before this body. So if anyone wishes to speak on anything, now's the time. Seeing none, bring it back to the commission. Is there any Planning Commission business? Okay. Consent calendar.
Move approval of item 1 and 2 on the consent calendar.
Second.
Roll call vote. Commissioner Benz, motion, and seconded by Commissioner Sturdivant.
Okay, Commissioner Benz?
Yes.
Commissioner Sturdivant?
Yes.
Commissioner Schmidt?
Yes.
Commissioner Ward?
Benz, and in TV land there, if you're new to this, we'll be talking about the housing requirements. It's a state requirement. We'll be talking about the breakdown of the housing, what our responsibilities are for percentage of the county housing in the very low, moderate, and different categories. We'll try to give you an understanding of the needs of the city for housing, understand the limitations, if any, to attaining the housing objective. And there are two objectives, one for the 2001 period, 2006. Second period is the 2007 to 2014. We'll review the opportunities the city has to make changes and evaluate the desirability and feasibilities of making changes, and then hopefully any recommendations that this any of the commissioners may have, the recommendations, and then we'll go on to the city council. So with those comments, I'd like to turn it over to Director Frace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. As you mentioned, tonight we are going to be looking at the housing element. The commission and council last held a joint session on this item in June. You took some public testimony and gave some direction on that. We've tried to incorporate most of those comments into this draft. So this is a draft tonight that you'll be looking at and making a recommendation to the city council. We're not actually considering the formal general plan amendment tonight. What we're considering is a draft document for submittal to the state of California. We expect that after we submit it to the state, there'll be a series of revisions and changes that will need to occur before the state deems it acceptable, and that once they've deemed it acceptable, then we'll do the formal adoption process. So It will come back to the Planning Commission City Council for formal adoption after the state review process is over. Lisa Wise, who is sitting next to me, is our consultant that's been hired to do the work. She'll be making the presentation tonight. So she has a presentation to give you an overview of the highlights. We know that there'll be a lot of questions and details that you want to get into, so we're not trying to hit all those items ahead of time in the presentation because that would be kind of lengthy. So we thought we would try to respond mainly to any questions and comments that you have about the housing element and what we're proposing tonight. So with that, I'll turn it over to Lisa.
Thank you, Warren. Thank you, commissioners and members of the public. We have, as Warren said, a short presentation. I have about 10 slides to hit some of the key points in the housing element. We did talk about some of the changes in state law last time and some of the basic requirements, but I'll hit on that again briefly. So the presentation is going to go over the state law, what the state law says about housing element updates, what the regional housing needs allocation is for the prior period and this period, and we're going to spend a little bit of time on that tonight. Some of the key programs and the update, and there's a lot of information in there too, but I'll hit on some of the key items. And then the update schedule and kind of where we are and what the next steps are. Also in the document, I believe section C, D, and E, where we've gone through demographics, affordability, special housing needs like homelessness, single families, farm workers, those kind of components. And then we've inventoried resources and constraints. Constraints are governmental and non-governmental constraints. Governmental constraints are things the city has control over. Non-governmental constraints are market conditions. That's also in the housing element update. And then we looked at resources for the city. We'll talk about that tonight. The major resources being the availability of land and then the redevelopment agency funding. And we have a couple slides to go over some of the key aspects of that. And then goals, policies, and actions is the final chapter of the housing element draft. And I'll go through some of the key policy program recommendations in that section. The next slide shows the regional housing needs allocation, sometimes referred to as RHNA, R-H-N-A. And this is broken out for the previous period, which was 2001 to 2006, and the current planning period, which is 2007 to 2014. The reason we need to look at the previous period is that the last housing element was not certified, so the state requires us to go back and look at those numbers under AB 1233, and we have some more analysis on that. I did want to point out on this slide, though, that in addition to the RHNA, the allocation is broken up by income category, very low, low, moderate, and above moderate, very low being up to 50% of median area income, low going from 50 to 80% of median area income, moderate going up to 120, and then above moderate being 120% of median family income. The previous RHNA from the 2001-2006 was 1,713 units. You can see that on the slide, and it's also in the housing element. The current allocation is much lower at 462 units. Now, there has been housing production against those numbers, and I'll go through that here in a minute to kind of show where we stand currently. And the housing element update. So this is the previous allocation, 2001-2006, the 1,713 units going across income categories. There were a number of units constructed over that planning period, 1,339 you can see is the total. Most of those are in the above moderate category, about 1,200 units. So those are market rate units primarily. We did have a few units that were deed restricted in the very low and low income categories, those being 31 and 46 units, and then we could push a few units that were a little bit higher density down into moderate income. The state wants us to look at, really concentrate on the very low and low units. That's why those, the 312 and the 193, are up on the screen and the total. The moderate and above moderate, we need to keep track of, but we don't need to specifically address those in programs in the housing element. So when we're looking at the housing element update and what we have left in terms of the previous allocation, we're looking at 505 units. This is the current planning period. This is 462 housing units across all income categories, very low, low, moderate, and above moderate. Again, we have had units constructed and approved, that's 160 units. And we can also take into account on the current RHNA vacant land available for housing construction. There is quite a bit of land out there. The vacant land can accommodate about 1,200 units, 1,000 on this. This is, again, AB 1233. The state requires us to have minimum density of 20 units per acre. When we rezone or upzone to meet the remaining allocation, 50% of it has to be on residentially zoned land, so we can have some commercial mixed-use opportunities or commercial property that allows residential uses, but half of it has to be on residentially zoned land. We have to allow multifamily by right without a conditional use permit. We can have design review, but the design review cannot trigger CEQA, a CEQA analysis. And generally, the sites have to be of a certain size. We're looking for about 16 units there. That's not really a problem here in the city, but just so we don't have a lot of really tiny sites as part of the sites analysis. This slide is a map. It's actually in your appendix, I think appendix 4. It goes through the potential sites for upzoning. These are all multifamily sites zoned 10 units per acre and 16 units per acre. If we potentially upzone these sites, we could meet our housing allocation to be in compliance with state law, as you can see. So this is El Camino Real, and that's 46. They're kind of scattered through town to the north and south. It's a little bit hard to see, but it's in the appendix. There's about 35 acres total.
Could we get a clarification on that? You had 100 for very low and 146 units for, no, it was low for 100 and very low for 146. In other words, the total came up to 246, and I thought the number we were looking for was 146.
Supposed to be 46 on the low, not 146.
Yes. Right. Sorry, that's a typo. That 146 should be a 46.
Thank you.
Yes, thanks. Sorry about that. I know just not what we need is more confusion in the numbers.
Just when I thought I had the numbers down.
I used to be an accountant, too. So we could talk. Anyway, moving forward, this is the map. It's in the appendix. I won't dwell on this anymore. It's a little bit difficult to read, but I just wanted to illustrate where the property was located and how it was spread out, not all concentrated necessarily. Then I have a couple of slides to go through some of the key programs. Program 111 and 112 addresses the RENA numbers. The first one is for the previous planning period, 2001 to 2006, the 505 units. The second one is the 146 units. For the current planning period, the reason we've broken them out is because the previous planning period has to be met within a year of adoption. So the timing is a little bit different, and that's why we have two programs. When you actually go through the process, you might want to consider dealing with it at one time, but just so to be clear and not to tie it all up in one program, that's why we broke it out into two, is because of timing under state law. There is a program 1111, proposal to adopt an inclusionary housing ordinance. Program 1112 is second units, evaluating that, particularly looking at potentially fees, parking issues, size requirements, those kind of things, going back to second unit opportunities in the city. Program 1114 deals with mixed use and allowing vertical mixed use and commercial rehab program, possibly giving low interest or zero interest loans for housing rehabs, plumbing, weatherization, ADA retrofits. Pismo has a very good example of that, and it's very effective. And then program 435 is potentially contributing funding for upper floor conversions into residential or deed restricted units, particularly in the downtown area. And then we have a program on the requirements of SB2, which is the program's 414 and the housing element, and that's a new state law. We need to find a site or some zones for an emergency shelter. It has to be allowed by right without a conditional use permit. So that's a recommendation in the housing element to bring the state into compliance with state law on emergency shelters. My last slide is just talk about schedule and timeline. So we are here in front of the Planning Commission tonight. We are scheduled to go to council on September 22nd. Depending on that meeting, we would send the housing element up to the state. They have a 60-day review period for their first review. As Warren said earlier, they'll issue a comment letter most likely. I haven't really seen any housing element that they didn't have something to improve upon. We would deal with those comments when we get them and come back probably to Planning Commission and then Council in a sequence of meetings. And adoption hearings then would be to be determined, but depending on how that review goes and comments from the Commission and the Council. So with that, I'll open it up to questions.
Commissioners, this is rather comprehensive and somewhat complicated. Is there a particular way that you'd like to, do you want to go through the whole housing element, or do you want to jump right to the goals?
I know where I want to start at.
Well, then, Commissioner Benz, step right up.
Okay. In reading through this document, your early presentation brought a question into my mind. Why aren't we concerned with the moderate and the other categories?
Above moderate?
Yeah, and above moderate, yeah. Why aren't we concerned with it? If it's in the report, well, why is it there if we aren't concerned with it?
Well, that's actually a good question. Countywide, the allocation for the current planning period is 4,885 in all income categories. The above moderate category is typically market rate units. So when they allocate the numbers, they give a chunk of those to market rate. They don't require any special processing or analysis by the city. The market will take care of those. Typically, cities are zoned for those kind of units. Moderate is a little bit more of a discussion. That is a little bit more of your workforce housing. It's a little bit under market. But when you think about rezones and the type of density you need for moderate, the city, most cities usually have the zoning for that, and there's no real impediments at the local level to fill that need. It's the very low and low when we're looking at a little bit higher density housing that the state really wants us to focus on. And that's why we have it in the housing element. We talk about it, but when we really kind of take the next step and look at government constraints, we're focusing on the very low and low-income units.
Well, then, are you saying that we don't have to monitor those two categories so that we can show that they do exist?
Typically, it could be single-family detached, townhouses, et cetera. Most jurisdictions can meet those units, and the state really just wants us to look at the very low and low units.
When I look at that chart, it would tell me that we were focused on doing above moderate and weren't doing too good of a job on the rest of them.
Well, what happens is because the housing market in the last 5 or 10 years and the frenzy in the market and the overbuilding, really a single-family detached, I think Atascadero is in the situation that most jurisdictions are in with the housing affordability and what's come online. And that's one of the reasons we're focusing, again, on the lower-income categories to make sure that there is housing for a broad section of the population. The market hasn't done a good job at that. And the city doesn't build housing, but the state just wants us to make sure at the local level that there aren't any constraints. If a developer comes forward, has the financing, wants to do a project, that it can move forward.
Okay. I'd like to have everyone turn to page 176 of the report. And in there, there's a table, V40, development fees for new housing. Single-family unit in Atascadero is $45,900 to $48,200. Multifamily is $34,700 to $38,100. Now, most people think that the developer pays this fee, and they do pay the fee, but they pass it on to the homeowner. And most people don't know that that fee, $45,900 or $48,200 or $34,700 or $38,100, also results in higher property taxes for the homeowner. And when you take a look at all of these numbers, these are impediments to low and moderate income housing. And I don't see a very good understanding in this report about how we're going to mitigate those problems, because we have not only the city to deal with, but we have the water district to deal with, and we have the school district to deal with. And so I did a couple charts here because I am an expert on property taxes. And on the $45,900, over a period of 50 years, that homeowner will pay an additional $38,821.95 in property taxes just for that unit. On the $48,200, they'll pay $40,767.27. On the multifamily, the $34,700, they'll pay $29,349.05. And on the $38,100, they will pay $32,224.75, in addition to paying those fees up when they buy the house. So I see very little mitigation in this report that shows me as a commissioner that we're really going to do something about this particular problem.
Well, you bring up a really good point. The fees are a constraint to affordable housing for very low and low income households, and you know, maybe up to 20% or more of housing.
Then, when we don't have really concrete, definite, measurable, quantifiable goals and objectives that we're holding, that the city is going to hold itself to, in order to prove to the state that we're serious about providing low and moderate income housing.
Well, I'm happy to strengthen the goals and policies and programs to meet your concerns, especially on fees. If you turn, there is a table 546 that deals with quantified objectives for the programs and actually lists what some of the targets potentially are for the city.
What page is that?
Page 82, I believe.
Page
199.
In the package.
Thank you.
Okay.
But you bring up a good point, and if it's the commission's recommendation to add a program or strengthen the language on dealing with fees, particularly for lower-income households, we can certainly add that to the housing element.
When I read the decreased governmental constraints on housing production on page 197, and you have a program to continue to consolidate all actions relating to a specific project on the same council or commission agenda. How are you going to go about doing that? I mean, we haven't been doing it in the past, but how are we going to go about doing that?
This was a permit streamlining or processing recommendation. It was in the previous housing element. I think it's something to work towards as far as approving projects, especially affordable housing projects, to save time. As you know, being in the real estate industry, time is money. Warren might want to add something exactly on the internal process, but it was something to save time. Another thing to consider with the new programs is these will be by right, so it'll basically go through design review, which is a streamlining mechanism in and of itself.
Typically, we're talking about where we would process legislative acts along with ministerial acts. So we would take the general plan amendment zone changes along with the use permits and tentative track maps. And that has been our policy, is to process those all through the commission and council concurrently. So we would continue to do them that way.
Well, our in this report, you do show lengthy timelines currently in place for getting approvals on projects within the community. And I know that we are supposed to be streamlining our permitting process, but I don't see where it's showing up on this chart in here about how many months we have to wait before someone can actually come in and pick up a building permit and start constructing.
Well, what we tried to do was reflect what the trends have been over the last couple of years, and due to the quantity of permits, if you go back 2 or 3 years, those are the averages. Right now, honestly, there are no residential projects going through any planning phase. So
the state can put their teeth into, as opposed to saying something continue or review or without a specific program in place to mention how it's going to change.
I'm through.
That's all you have to say? Okay, Commissioner Sturdivant.
Yeah, in looking at this report, this is when this goes to the state, this is going to be our game plan for how we're going to accommodate the numbers that we are getting from the county, correct? Is that?
Yes.
Because one piece of the puzzle here is that the redevelopment funds it talks about when it comes to financing or helping people get into things, properties or buying a home or all the different things they talked about with that, with it being taken by the state, our redevelopment funds for our city being taken, how is that going to be, how is that going to affect this? Because that is a piece of this element.
Well, you're right. I mean, the redevelopment balance is, this is a recommendation based on the balance right now. There are recommendations if the balance changes or you decide to pursue one program or the other, that's at the option of the city. The state won't hold you to that. These are just recommendations and ideas based on previous input we got from the Joint Planning Commission Council meeting and also earlier discussions with the stakeholders.
Okay, so would that be part of when you're saying we're going to submit this and then there's going to be 60 days in comments, would that kind of be where we're at? They're going to be looking at, we're saying this is what we're going to do, but then, you know, in reality, some of this may not work. And is that kind of some of what they're looking at as to what may really help this to go forward in reality, or how does that?
Well, in terms of the redevelopment funds, the state is taking away redevelopment funds from the city, but those are the 80% that's not allocated for affordable housing. The 20% that's restricted for affordable housing isn't being affected by the state takeaways. So the state takeaway, in other words, does not have an impact on our affordable housing accounts or the policies that we've proposed at this point.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Commissioner Benz, on the same subject.
On the same subject, the redevelopment agency funds. The city is going to have to pay $1.3 million, and they can use the low and moderate income housing fund. They can borrow that money from that low and moderate income housing fund, which has a little over $5 million in it. But they could use, the city could borrow that money from the low and moderate income house fund, thereby reducing the amount available. But the city also has its own in lieu fund for low and income, low and moderate income. It has $2 million in it. The city has had a sizable amount of money available for low and moderate income housing, but we haven't been very active in adopting programs that would allow us to spend that money on the low and moderate income housing needs of the community. Thank you.
Any other questions on this topic? One question.
We could certainly add a statement that the assuming funding availability and that the state doesn't get into city coffers. There's nothing wrong with adding a language like that based on the uncertainty of the fiscal and situation at the state level.
Is that something that we could all kind of consensus on, that we'd have something like that? Okay. Thank you. Commissioner Schmidt.
Yes. I have specific comments dealing with your summary at the beginning of the housing element, draft housing element that you provided to us. And I want to start with on page 46 under analysis. And it states, as part of the state mandates for housing elements, the staff and our consultant have included a number of new policies and programs that have made modifications to others, which will require further action by the PC and by the City Council in the form of municipal code updates and general plan amendments. And then there's a list of what they are, 9 of them. And at the very beginning of this, there's a discussion also about CEQA analysis or the lack thereof at this point because of the process that's we're going about. And I'm kind of wondering if it's somewhat backwards in the sense that, let's say we make these changes and the state adopts them and certifies them. And then we go forward and with the zoning changes or with the GP amendments that are going to be needed, and they don't get approved. What is the result of those things not occurring? Is that somehow decertify the document, or has that become problematic in the future?
Well, the state will look at for us to implement the housing element, in particular the meeting the housing allocation numbers. A lot of the programs are shoulds or will evaluate. I'm not exactly sure if that addresses your question, but the primary thing they're going to be looking at is that we meet the allocation numbers and the rezones, and those have really particular implementation timeframes on them and the under each program.
So it's still somewhat of a number crunch.
Yeah, unfortunately, it is a bit of a number crunch at this point with the state certification process.
Okay. Are you aware of Palmer and 6th Street versus the City of L.A. and the ruling of the 4th District Court on inclusionary housing?
I am not, but I have been following inclusionary ordinances and the requirements. So I think they were looking for a nexus study on that particular ordinance, unlike the Napa case where they did not need a nexus study.
Yeah, somewhat. I was just wondering if there's any thoughts about how that might impact our inclusionary housing ordinance in the city.
Well, this would be a topic, I think, for your city attorney. The way the program's written, it's sort of a let's move forward on this. I think to some extent the city's been doing this inclusionary for larger projects anyway. Mm-hmm. But when you actually undertook the ordinance, you would have to look at the requirements for the Mitigation Fee Act and what you would need to do based on recent court legislation.
Okay. On the top of page... so many scribbles. On top of page 47, where you have the tables listing.
No, there's no hard and fast analysis on that for what the state's looking for. It's a little bit flexible of how we can address it. The housing element looks at affordability at the current income levels, which is the second table on that page. I think staff was just going back to the previous housing element and those income levels for that.
Yeah. Okay. There's a discussion about establishing or having a program to establish minimum densities on certain projects. Is there any quantifiable information about how successful those are? And the reason why I ask, and kind of the question that I posed to myself, if water, sewer services are scarce, then it's going to be difficult to meet minimum numbers, whereas we might be able to meet something less than a minimum number, but we have that number drafted in the document. We have to hold to it, so it might prevent the development of some units
because of it. Right. I think when that would happen, it would require a little bit of analysis. One of the concerns was that some of the multifamily zoning was getting used up by single-family detached or lower density. The maximum was 10 or 16, and it was getting built out. You were losing your multifamily property for lower density development. That said, under the upzoning and programs 1 or 2, we are looking at minimum 20 units per acre on those properties. So to some extent, we're addressing that on some of the ones properties that we will upzone to meet the allocation. It was just going back and considering that for some of the other multifamily housing or sites, if you really did want to maintain them for multifamily or higher density housing, to set some threshold. And, you know, the threshold is to be determined based on site analysis, slopes, capacity, those kind of considerations.
I was quite intrigued by the discussion about by right development. And I just kind of, so I can understand it, wrote myself a note. So fictitiously, if I have a by right site that's 1 acre, then I can propose 20 units, but the state's only expecting me to maybe get 80% or 16 of those units in. Is that?
Yeah, I think we can take into account some site constraints, especially when we actually do the upzones and the CEQA analysis, but we will need to find enough sites at a reasonable density to meet the allocation when the city goes through that process. It is a minimum of 20, but Warren and I have been talking about that too. A lot of projects that are coming in are in the low 20s, so it didn't seem like a huge impediment looking at this analysis, given some of the recent activity at the city.
The very last paragraph deals with providing some type of control over right to development homes by having a review of architecture and so on by the Planning Commission. And then there's a statement that says, to ensure that the projects are compatible with surrounding neighborhoods, staff will recommend the zone change required to allow development of sites by right to include provisions for the PC level of architectural review. And I was kind of asking myself, how do you see this happening in the sense that we don't, within our general plan, I don't think we have a lot of definitions for what compatibility is in certain areas. I mean,
the zoning ordinance on design review or with design review guidelines, I think that would be something to consider or undertake when you actually do go through the upzoning process on those particular sites, since they will be by right. You have the option for design review, but they will be by right. If you want to revisit anything in your general plan, your design review and your zoning ordinance to have particular findings or develop more particular design review regulations for multifamily housing, those would be some of the options available to the city to address, I think, some of your concerns.
Would there be maybe a new zoning category that would be right development, by right development zoning category, and then maybe some specific standards that would address that zoning category? I mean, kind of speculating, I guess.
You could do it in your zones. The way I think the simplest way is just to allow multifamily by right instead of with a conditional use permit in those zones, but you could actually also change your zoning and have some kind of zoning that was more form-based or more particular, so you were more certain of the outcome. Mm-hmm. With your standards, so that would be something else to consider as you kind of move through this process and address that allocation need.
And Warren might need to address this. When you have inclusionary housing, are capital facility impact fees, are those fees that were addressed in the table that we looked at before, do those also apply to inclusionary housing?
Yeah, the capital facility fees apply to all residential and commercial permits that we issue. We do have a sliding scale on the fee amount, so the smaller units in the multifamily zones pay a smaller fee, so that's already built into our tables to a certain degree. But the smaller units would also pay a capital facility fee, just like the larger ones.
How is that an incentive to want someone to want to do inclusionary housing? It seems like, I mean, I could maybe get more units without, as the document says, without anything being taken away by my market share, but I'm going to be still having to put this money up to build those units. And it doesn't seem as much of an incentive. And for now, and lastly, there was a comment that Lisa had made about the market hasn't addressed, you know, the low to moderate conditions. And I, you know, one of the comments I've made before is that, but the public has, and you can see it when you drive down the street, and there's going to be 6 or 10 cars parked out in the front yard of a home that might be moderate or just below moderate. And so that consuming public has made the adjustment themselves. They, instead of having 5 people in the household, they have 10 or 12 people in the household, and they reduce the cost that way. And so this is kind of how these elements really don't address those type of changes that are occurring. And, again, when we have our standard formulas, it doesn't fit, but the people themselves are making the adjustment. And by numbers are lowering the cost so they can live in a certain area. For now, thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Ward?
Well, I will spare you my comments about this being based on central planning and not being marked. To build affordable homes, a couple of meetings ago, I sat here and 2 or 3 builders spoke to us on how they absolutely cannot build affordable housing based on the high price of land and these abusively high fees. Also, the classic model, if somebody was building 10 units, he would jack up the price on 8, knock down the price on 2, and say these are my affordable houses. But now, because there's such a profit squeeze on builders, that they just don't have this profit margin where they can do this. So, you know, you can have this thing that's being driven down the railroad tracks from Sacramento, but as a practical matter, I don't see how this city or any city is going to force builders to build affordable housing under these conditions. Now, what I'm suggesting is that there are a lot of second units around, and I think if the city had a realistic amnesty program, instead of saying come forward and your sins are forgiven, but you've got to pay us $20,000, that's not practical. But there are dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds of second units that are filling this low income need of the community, and somehow our city is not being given credit, and I think we should. And this program, I just want to echo what's been said. The fees have to come down, but then you're spreading that among everybody else, and that doesn't appear to be fair. So I think, as Commissioner Schmidt said, the system is taking care of itself right now, and somehow those numbers have to go into this plan to reflect it, because I don't see hundreds of people sleeping under bridges around here. They're living in houses. They're living two or three families to a house. And that I think, is filling a need. It perhaps not maybe an ideal need, but I think it needs to be addressed in this survey.
Any other comments? Vice Chairperson Moreno.
Thank you. Shifting gears, let's see. On page 127, this is looking at the previous draft. It says, let's see, it's a program 414, expand code enforcement and neighborhood preservation programs to eliminate areas of blight and nuisances from existing neighborhoods. And then the achievement is that that's ongoing, that we hired a code enforcement officer in 2004 to enhance the policy implementation capabilities. So, Director, I was wondering if you could let us know, where has this been occurring? What areas of blight have been, you know, fixed and taken care of? How is this going?
The majority of the areas that we've identified as blighted are within the redevelopment areas, which are around the downtown core and some of the higher density areas. So those are areas that are specifically looked at as part of our code enforcement programs, although code enforcement is not just limited to those areas. So our code enforcement officer will look at those areas, make sure that some cases of substandard or blighted housing, that we have something proactive that we can offer beyond just code enforcement.
Okay. So that's not written specifically in here. I mean, you do have the you have it here as a goal in terms of the numbers on page 199, and so that's how that is kind of carried over then. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. If you look on page 195, program 3 at the bottom there is to consider a housing rehabilitation program, mm-hmm. and that's the purpose of that program. That would specifically target some of our low moderate income housing funds for the purposes of dealing with those sorts of situations.
Okay, and that would be using the redevelopment money.
Correct.
And is that, when we're talking redevelopment money, as Commissioner Sturdivant asked, we're talking the $320,000 that's currently in there. Is that correct, or is there another amount?
No, there's over $4 million, I think.
There's over $4
million. Yeah,
that's a much better number than 320.
Yeah, the 20% set-aside account is in the $4 million range, and then I think the in lieu fee is, I think, the other number in the 400,000 range.
Of. Okay, I think that was 320. Okay, so the $4 million that's in redevelopment is specifically for housing and not taken by the state. That's the form. Okay.
Currently, yes.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Next, on page 142. Number three, under housing conditions, it said that city staff conducted a visual housing condition survey, randomly selected and evaluated 200 properties. So I'm assuming that was from all properties, not specifically affordable housing properties.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's a state requirement, too, that we do a housing condition survey.
Okay. And then basically what comes out of that, it kind of says that you do this, you assess these things, and then that tells you if things need to be rehabilitated and brought into that program?
It tells you the extent of the problem, I think, locally. There is some rehabilitation needs in the city, you know, as compared to other cities statewide. It's not as a large of a concern. Just as a benchmark, though, PISMO set aside $800,000 of the redevelopment funds for their rehab program, mm-hmm. and they give loans up to $20,000. You know, you don't think of PISMO as being a blighted area, but there are needs everywhere, and they've actually had a lot of requests for their rehab funds.
Okay. All right. That was 142. All right. On page 150, I just needed a clarification. At the top of the page, large families and overcrowding. A household over five persons is considered to be a large family, and then we go on to say five or more. So is it one to, like five and under or over five? It's not clear.
Large households are five or more. So it's five or more.
Okay, that should be reworded then. It says over five persons okay. is considered, so it should say over four or five or more. Okay, mm-hmm. thank you. Is it? I was not familiar with this ordinance, but on page 172, it said that the city adopted an ordinance requiring fire sprinklers in all newly constructed residential units. That's not with any proximity to fire stations or square footage or anything, all new residential construction?
It's actually all new construction. So,
all new construction.
Yeah, I think it was 2003, 2004, the ordinance was changed, and all new structures are required to have fire sprinklers now.
Wow, okay. Well, let's see, page 193.
Let me, before you go on, Vice Chair Moreno, I'd like to ask a question relative to the last topic. Why would there be a need? I mean, what was the rationale behind the fire sprinklers on everything? I can understand some of the outlying areas in that, particularly with the geography that we have to cover. But for
all of those, then you throw the sprinklers into the mix, and what are you talking, another 15,000 maybe?
There's different numbers that have been bannered about the cost. The big cost is retrofitting, but on new construction, I believe that the number is somewhere between $1 and $2 a square foot. Seems like everybody will accept that on a reasonably sized building. In single-family residential, the systems are a lot lighter weight. They're not the heavy commercial-grade systems, so the cost is not that excessive in single-family residential or multifamily applications.
Oh, I'm surprised. Okay.
Chairperson Jack.
Commissioner Schmidt.
I also want to note that the 2007 fire code that was adopted by the city includes a requirement that any building over 1,000 square feet must be sprinkled. And so it's kind of by de facto when we adopt those documents, then those things come along with it. And sometimes we can selectively take them out if we want, but normally it doesn't happen.
Okay, page 193, let's see, policy 3-1, number 4, talking about AB 811, and it's saying wishing to install solar panels, and I believe I remember from our discussion, I think just a week or so ago on that, isn't it more than just solar panels?
Yeah, it also is energy efficiency improvements.
Okay, we just might want to rephrase that, take out the specific of the solar panel, but just mention the energy efficiency improvements. And then,
one of the things that I'd like to do, let me interrupt here just a minute, is once we're through with the different topics, I want to come back and go through the entirement goal section, goal by goal, and make sure that we're in agreement with it. Okay. Go ahead.
And then On page 182, under global climate change, the first paragraph, is that first paragraph, is there a necessity for that, any sort of legal requirement that that has to be there?
There's no requirement that has to be there. So if there's something there that you want to reword or don't like, we can certainly address that.
My preference would be that that entire paragraph be removed, as it doesn't seem to be at all necessary, and some people would say not agreed upon by all by all experts. So I'd rather remove that and then just go into the other. And I don't know how many fellow commissioners
do we have consensus on that? Because I'm definitely in agreement with the recommendation. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And then lastly, and I don't know if you're able to answer this, but, you know, rental versus home ownership, you know, a lot of people would argue that, you know, owning a home is preferable to renting. Obviously, some of us who own homes, every time something goes wrong, wish we could call the landlord. So there are pros and cons. How do we look at, you know, the availability?
Home buyer program. Mm-hmm. There is a first-time home buyer program recommendation in there, though. So if there were low or moderate income households that you wanted to attempt to do some gap funding for, that's an option. But because a subsidy is so large, once you get down to those income levels, mm-hmm. it just becomes a matter of efficiency and how you want to allocate your funds.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And I figured that was probably the answer, but mm-hmm. just wondering if there was a another way to look at that. Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Schmidt.
I'd like to dive into second homes, please. And on page 170 and 171, there's a discussion about second homes. And on page 171, the last paragraph on that section, there's a reference to program 3.1.2. And I'm wondering, when I read 3.1.2, it says make available in the Community Development Department brochures from PG&E and others that detail energy conservation measures. Wondering how that mixes in with the discussion on secondary housing, thinking that there just might be an incorrect reference. It also cross-references Section F, the very last sentence, parenthetically, see Section F, housing resources, infrastructure resources, and there's a discussion about it. And I just want to kind of open up discussion so people know what happens with the water company is that they have a policy that they adopted in 1979 that says new dwellings pay impact fee. And at that time, it was a very small amount. Now it's $19,600. I've been having a discussion with them and trying to see if there's anything that could be done. And the manager of the water company who visited us a while back when he had a project to us, John Neal, had suggested that an appeal be made to the board of directors that they reconsider the impact fee for secondary homes that are of a specific size. And Lisa had recommended an increase to 1,100 square feet in the document that we have. But he felt that there might be some type of a break that might be able to be reached with the water company on this. And I always kind of point out that I can buy a modular home or I can build a second house on my property that's two bedrooms and one bath, and I have to pay an impact fee. But if I add two bedrooms and one bath to my house, I don't have to pay an impact fee. And the size could be exactly the same. And so I would like to, in the programs, as Commissioner Ward and Commissioner Bentz were talking about, is to maybe quantify some specific goals or methodology to reach some of the goals, and in this case, direct staff to approach the water company and request them to reconsider the fees for secondary homes. And I also think, as we talked before at the previous hearing, I think that there's some things that the city can do to help the water company and trying to establish an impact fee program. Rent them out at the costs that were listed in there, what, $1 or $2 a square foot, whatever it was. Most of them are much cheaper, and it's a shame that it's that way. And thank you.
Yeah, could you elaborate a little bit on that as to why it is account, why we can't account for, get more count out of the second unit?
The way the second unit analysis was done, it looked at past trends in permitting for second units. For instance, though, how many people actually came in and got a permit for a second unit, and then it converted that into roughly what they would rent for based on a recent study done by the city on real estate costs and rental prices. That was the it's one way to do it. We could talk about another methodology to possibly count additional units. But we do need to look at past trends as far as permitting. So unless there's really – the state won't accept any other methods there. But if we want to dig into affordability more, we could talk about other options there. If there's one place we worked, we did a survey, for instance, to kind of look at affordability. I don't know if we could talk to realtors and get a better idea what prices are. If you think they're more affordable than the numbers we have in our report, so – there's no hard and fast method for the affordability, but we really can't count a lot more units than the city's been permitting on average. On the water question, though, in Program 12, there is a statement about working with the water company on fees. So we did try to address that. We can certainly strengthen that, though, too. It's 1.1.12.
Yes,
and the cross-reference was wrong with the program number. Yeah. You're right about that, Commissioner. Yeah.
I did read that the 1.1.12, and I did see that and was happy to see, and all, at least addressed in some way. Can we use the classified ads to identify what the cost of rentals are? Because when I look through them they seem pretty low. But I don't know if that's quantifiable enough for the state.
We can go back and review some of that information on the web and with realtors and ads, certainly.
Now, most of the data that we're working with on this report is based on the 2000 census. So there's been, which is at best going to be questionable. I don't know how else to put that, but because there's been such a dramatic change in the housing, both availability and affordability in just the last 2 years, that it's had a tremendous impact on a lot of these numbers. So, I mean, what value are we going to take away, or is the state going to take away with this, or do they care?
You're exactly right. It's unfortunate the timing of the housing element update this cycle and the fact that we are relying on old census numbers and they don't come out yet. For much of the data that the state wants us to look at, though, there's no other sources available. So that's the best available data, affordability.
Is there a number of actually how many homes have been built in low and low income? I mean, I'm not talking about just us. I'm saying in general, in all the cities and all the plans.
Oh, city, statewide?
Yeah, statewide.
I don't have that number off the top of my head. The state did put out some recent figures, though, showing how we were overbuilt in single-family detached, and we were underbuilding higher-density housing at about 200,000 units per year. I think mm-hmm. the number was 220, actually. Mm-hmm. That gives you an idea of where we kind of were, how we were missing our target annually, over 200,000 a year units statewide for higher-density, lower-income housing.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else? All right. I've got
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
You might want to open this up for public comment before we get too far into deliberations.
Okay. No, I was just going to talk about Section E and go through that And then before we go into the goals and that, maybe then get the input from the public, if that's okay. The question I have on this, on the special housing needs, we've got a lot of different categories. Now, are there specific, and you know, I'm naive in this, and so I'm using this as a learning experience here, but we've got senior households, we've got persons with disabilities, we've got persons in need of emergency shelter and that. Do we have a specific group of programs and policies that deal with this, or, you know, for example, persons in need of emergency shelter. We have an emergency shelter requirement. And I'm just not, I see the analysis here, and but what is, what does the city do? What do we do in achieving the needs of emergency shelter, obviously, what single family households is a big one to me. Because we have, you know, about 23% of our households are single-family households, and that's a difficult part. Single-parent. Oh, single-parent, I'm sorry.
These are the six categories that the state wants us to analyze. So it's seniors, disabled households, large families, single-parent households, homeless and farm workers, and we go through that analysis to show if there's any particular need that the city wants to address. For instance, you know, we work with jurisdictions in the Valley and the Salinas Valley and the Central Valley. Farm workers is a big issue. We need to put special attention to that. Through our analysis, nothing came up except homelessness, and there's an
goes up and then comes back with state comments after it goes through the city council. So we'll have the flexibility to tailor specific programs to accommodating those needs. Okay.
And that's a good point. This is a draft. You'll have additional chances to look at the draft. We'll get the state letter. We'll bring that back. We'll have recommendations. You'll get another chance to kind of go through it because I understand, realize it's a lot of information, and as you kind of sift through it and think about it more, you might have additional comments and thoughts. So there is more opportunity to kind of weigh in on particular items.
I hesitate to take that opportunity following it coming back because once it comes back from the state, I don't think short of, you know, something major that's been missed, we aren't going to have the opportunity to make much change in it.
Well, we could certainly work with the commission, though, on items that I thought we thought would be problematic for the state and items that we thought were beneficial to the city and wouldn't raise a red flag for the HCD.
Okay. Okay, very good. At this point, if there's anyone in the public that would like to weigh in any manner, shape, or form within reason, please approach the lectern. Good evening. Just a moment, please.
Okay, thank you. Pearl Munak, and I'm president of the Transitional Food and Shelter Incorporated, which is a nonprofit which serves disabled homeless people. And we have the temporarily disabled, and then they can just go out of the program as soon as they get well. But we also have the permanently disabled, and we can't let them go until they get housing because it wouldn't be safe. So, I mean, each one of them has got a doctor's note that says that they They can't be just out during the day. So, and you know, many of them have emphysema, end-stage emphysema, terminal cancer, that sort of thing, and they're getting SSI at most. This is a problem because we can't get them into housing fast enough. We wind up keeping them too long in a temporary program. We serve 300 to 400 people a year, but that's for the whole county. Now, most of those, or more than half of those, are in the North County. So we've got 5 apartments in Atascadero and 2 in Paso Robles, and that's where we keep them. But the problem is, if you're getting SSI, you're not just low income. You're just very, very, very low income. That Villa Paseo up by Templeton that used to be the Ramada Inn is now a senior. Folks that are built are family or they're senior, but none for disabled. And some of our clients are seniors, but most are in their 40s and 50s, and they have gotten degenerative diseases early in life, comparatively. And they can't get into the senior housing. They also don't fit well into the family housing because the family housing charges rent that's higher than they can pay. It's perfectly good for low-wage employees, but it's too high for people on SSI.
So, excuse me. So you're asking?
Well, I'm asking, how do we get housing for people whose income is so low that they would really be stretching to pay $600 a month, and they're not seniors, and they don't need a 2-bedroom or a 3-bedroom like most of the family housing is.
Do you have any idea what the population for the city of Atascadero in that category might be?
Of the ones that we serve, it would be
I'm just curious as to
maybe 100
that would fall into this category within the city of Atascadero?
Yeah.
Okay.
So when there was the Carlton, like a residential hotel, I don't know what they charged for rent, but that probably took some of the pressure off. What they call SRO, that means, single room occupancy, and it sounds like it means standing room only, which it almost is, but if there was anything like that, you know, if they had, instead of a kitchen, just a small refrigerator and a microwave, you know, they could live in there. That would be fine. Many people are trying to stay in motels where they don't have a kitchen, and they could do it, except the motels cost too much. So many people, they'll go to a motel for, you know, maybe a week or two out of their month, and then they're out for the rest of the month. And it's not good to have people who are seriously ill out.
No, absolutely not. Okay. Ms. Munak, thank you very much. We'll try and address those here in a few minutes.
Hi, Susan Warren, and I'm here in Atascadero, and I'm a director with North County Connection, which is a community recovery resource center. And kind of along the same lines that Pearl was talking about, we work with a lot of families who are clean and sober, and then the whole complex decided not to take Section 8. And we saw a number of the families literally have to move from the area because they were unable to stay here in Atascadero. And a lot of them had grown up here. They've been here for many years. They had jobs. You know, they were doing the best they can with their families and putting their lives back together. But they literally had to relocate when the Section 8 was dropped. And so that's a concern that I wonder if that's being addressed in this element is encouraging multifamily units or people to make sure that they're providing enough opportunities for people to use their Section 8, which would allow them to stay here in the community.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Warren. Anyone else? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the commission. Commissioner Benz.
Yes, a question for Warren. Warren, do we have a voucher program?
Yes.
In this city?
Yeah, we do participate in a motel voucher program.
Is that a pretty costly item to the city?
It's funded, I believe, through our community development block grant program, so I think it's an annual allocation that the city council makes. There's lots of need there. It's somewhat of a competitive process, but the council makes that decision on an annual basis about how much will be allocated to each group.
So do you know how much the city contributes in a voucher program for the homeless?
I don't know the number.
Okay. Thank you.
I can just add that the city gets 278 Section 8 vouchers from the Housing Authority of San Luis Obispo. And when we last spoke to them, there were about 120 people on the waiting list for Section 8 vouchers in the city, just to give you an idea of some of the magnitude.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for staff?
We were going to go through the
yeah, I want to clear this up and see if I can get more definitive response to the questions. Director Frace, can you shed a little bit more light on both the disabled, primarily the disabled issue?
Lisa has a little bit more information on that.
Okay.
On some of the questions that came up with folks that only receive Social Security, we do have some analysis of extremely low-income households, which are households that own 30% of median household income. Median household income is about $70,000 in the county. So the state does require us to look at that. Under the state methodology, we had about 53 households, which might be low, but there is some analysis on that in the housing element to start to bring light to it. We've also, in the programs on the quantified objectives, looked at identifying some housing for extremely low-income households. It's very hard to meet those needs because the subsidies are so deep and the needs are fairly large. Just as a kind of another number to throw out there, there's almost 300 folks homeless in Atascadero.
Marital status, ancestry, national origin, color, familial status, or disability. Maybe we could add a policy within the policies or within the goals that we have to address this area specifically. I'll note that policy 4.2 talks about the voucher program. That's on page 193. But we'll be getting into that if we're going to go this line by line you were talking about. So,
yes, I think since this is what's going to go and our recommendation to the council, I would like to make sure that we go through it. There's a few typos. There's a few other things in it. And make sure that we've touched all the bases because, frankly, that's our job.
Well, we could add a specific policy
yes,
to this.
If you'll bring it up at that
issues,
time. When we,
yeah.
Yeah. Very good. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Do you have something? Okay, so then let's go to Section H, Housing Element Goals, Policies, and Programs, and kind of go through these.
187, beginning.
And so we'll start with the first one, which is to promote diverse and high-quality housing opportunities to meet the needs of all segments of the community. Is there anything that anyone... Lisa, question. As we go down through these, some of these will have quantified objectives. Now, these are all tied back in. I did not go through and add these up and back them in, trusting that you've already done this. So these tie back into the specific housing numbers that we're working toward.
Yes, they do. And having quantified objectives is a requirement of the state. It's not an exact science. There is potentially some overlap between programs, but it's an estimate on a program-by-program basis, potentially how many units could be produced.
Okay, thank you very much. And I clarified one question I had on the first paragraph with Director Frace on the justification may not count capacity on the same sites for both planning periods, even though it would be a new structure or a new ability to cover an issue. So I guess we're stuck there. Anyone have any? Commissioner Schmidt?
Yes, on Program 1 under Policy 1.1.
Yes.
The second paragraph, it discusses the 2001-2006 Regional Housing Need Assessment. And there is a statement in there about making these units by right development.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, because this is going back to the uncertified document and we're bringing it up to speed through this program, was that...
Housing element last time to rezone it by right this time. Yeah, so they're kind of catching you.
Just a general question. Do we have to bring the 2001-2006 and get it certified before we can get the 2000 to 2014 certified?
No, you don't have to go back and get the previous one certified. If we address it in our programs now, that'll catch you up.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or comments on goal number one? Is there anything you want to add in that category? Okay, seeing none, let's move on to... Wait a minute. I do have a couple of comments here. On item 5, I'm fairly sure I know the answer to this, but I just want to ask the question anyway. I assume for this purpose that there is an acceptable separate designation for motorhome versus mobile. Versus mobile home, that there's two distinct categories?
Yes, there is. And motorhomes are actually regulated by the DMV as vehicles.
Yes.
Versus these other things.
Okay. Now, on the Eagle Ranch, I'd like to talk about number 6 there. The extension and expansion of sewer service for the Eagle Ranch annexation area by allocating the funding necessary, and then the quantified objective of 100 affordable units. How did we arrive at the 100 affordable units for that? I'm somewhat having attended several of the Eagle Ranch meetings and talked to the owners. I think I'd like a little more information on this, because I see where it could be a problem.
It's just a target, and it was an estimate based on 20% of approximately 500 units. It's not something we need to stick to. If we think the number's uncertain, we could discuss that, but that's how we got to the number.
I'd rather on the Eagle Ranch, because that hasn't even come before us yet. It's still in the county. I'm not sure I'm comfortable attaching a number to that that's utilized to meet our current goals.
We could add just to be determined there. You know, that would be fine. It just was an estimate based on the information we have, but we don't have to be wedded to that number.
Commissioner Moreno, Vice Chair Moreno.
Chairman. It's my understanding from talking with the director earlier today that with the rezoning, we meet our requirements. So everything from 3 forward is unrealistic. So I'm not too torn up about that.
About the 100?
Yeah, I'm okay keeping that.
My only concern on that is that it adds another level of complexity to getting the project, because the owner of those properties have the existing plan is an attempt at honoring some of the smart growth principles and expanding the level of open space, but you start adding a lot of additional conditions on this. They automatically have the right to go back to their colony lot and build those as they see fit. And
but I don't think we're putting additional restrictions, and if we are, then I'd like clarification. I mean, they're already going to be subject to the inclusionary housing of 20%, and that's all we're really talking about here. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the program says support. If the annexation didn't occur for some reason, the state would not hold you to these numbers. It's just an estimate, knowing that that's a project out there in the pipeline to get, you know,
and
put
it's
it
just on straight what their inclusionary housing would be anyway. We're not adding other restrictions or anything on top of them with this. This is just, hey, here's something out there, and best case scenario, we could have 100 affordable units there. Is that what we're saying?
That's correct.
Okay. Any other comments? Everyone's okay with that? Okay.
On number 6?
Yes. Commissioner Sturdivant?
I have a question.
Okay. Commissioner Schmidt, did you have any comment on that?
I want to move on to 7.
Okay. go right ahead. Move on to 7.
I'm interested in knowing how the, and we've kind of been harping on it myself, the public facility impact fee affects mixed-use development. Is there an impact fee for commercial use as well as the residential use, or is it somehow residential exempt from that?
We have the council has adopted schedule for both residential and for commercial. So residential impact fees are charged on a unit basis. So it doesn't really matter how big the unit is in a certain zone, it pays the same fee. In the commercial, office, industrial zones, the fee is based on a square footage. So every square foot adds an additional multiplier to the fees. So if you build a mixed-use project that would, say, have 5 residential units and 10,000 square feet of commercial, we would charge you a cap fee on 5 units and then 10,000 square feet times whatever the resident or the commercial multiplier is. And that's what the total cap fee on the project would be.
In penciling it out, is the commercial less than the residential?
Cool. Yes.
So where is the incentive for mixed use? And kind of, again, I'm going to be paying this great fee for the residential use, and I know that I can build commercial space.
No. Okay.
And, I mean, I'd like to put it in there, yes. Or in, you know, it might be a better place to place the discussion about the public facility impact fee, or that there be a the start of a cost benefit analysis to see if the fee is too much or too little, and so we kind of know where we're at, and collecting it, and then if it's, you know, is it worth the amount that we're, and the benefit that we're being derived from it, is it worth the cost or is it prohibitive? I mean, I would like to have that area addressed, but I don't know if item 7, because it's focuses strictly on mixed-use development, is the place for us to put that in as a program.
Should we take this up under the...
We could take it up under government constraints. And I think Program 7 is just allowing more flexibility based on the developer's pro forma. If it turned out that second-story office would pencil out better, it doesn't preclude that as an option. It's just that if you, you know, you're not going to probably have too much second-story retail. You might have second- or third-story office. And if the developer did not want to do that, he could do second- or third-story residential if it made sense in his pro forma. It's just it's an alternative. I'm not...
Okay. It's just that there's such a emphasis being placed on mixed use. I mean, it's you know, that's avant-garde at this point. So if I want to get a project passed, I know if I put the spin of mixed use on it, it's going to look a little bit better in the approval process. Anyway, we'd move on, please.
Okay. Commissioner Benz?
Yes, on that matter,
I believe that there's a the staff is going to be reviewing our capital impact fee schedule, and that could be part of your review, right?
Yes, we actually are overdue for a review of the cap fee system. So some of the direction that we're hoping to get out of the housing element will provide us some direction on how exactly to go through that audit or review process.
And that will come back to the commission for approval, will it not?
The cap fee schedule does not. It's strictly a council decision. But the council will obviously take direction from the general plan. So if it's clear from general plan policy that we want to look at cap fees in certain categories for certain reasons, then definitely staff will look at that and we'll present that to the council.
So I think Commissioner Schmidt was really speaking about business friendly. Mm-hmm. And I believe the council is business friendly. And so I would think that this commission would want to have some input on any modifications to that particularly important fee schedule that creates disincentives, or whether it's going to provide incentives for low and moderate income housing as well as business.
Business, and I'm a community family person, and I think that our community, its strength is in our families. And when this fee is being attached to homes, and I don't know how many people I've.
Well, do we want to address it now while we're what's fresh in our mind and add some language, or do you just want to direct us to go back and?
All right, let's address the issue.
Would be under.
It would be Program 7 under Policy 6.1, so you'd be on page 198. So Program 7 would be a spot to mm-hmm. or to insert a new program.
And the suggested language? Did you have some or?
I don't have any specific language. I think generally you could direct staff to develop a program 7 to look at reviewing the capital facility fee schedule so as to create incentives for affordable housing, something to that effect.
You know, it goes a lot deeper for me in the sense that I don't pay that fee on my house. I'm not in the district, right? But I'm benefiting as a property owner in the city because someone else is paying that fee. And there are services or fire engines or police cars or whatever it is that the fees are used that are going to be helping me, although I'm not contributing into it. And so it's almost like that the purpose of the fee is that development pay its fair share, but development's actually paying more than its fair share with it. And that's where my beef is right there. It's not fair.
Well, just to clarify, because that's kind of a sticky legal point, is that we can't charge more than a project's fair share. So based on Assembly Bill 1600, we have to go through a fairly lengthy process to demonstrate that they are only paying the fair share, because that is the state requirement. So I just want to clarify, because this is on TV, that the city's opinion is that the development is only paying their fair share and not anything in addition to that.
Yeah, I agree with that, but it's paying for me. I'm benefiting from it, although I'm not in. I don't have that Melrose fee on my home. Adding it as a program under 6.17 is fine, and the direction in which you were talking is acceptable.
May I? And I'm thinking even to further clarify, rather than just incentivize affordable housing, I would stick to incentivizing low and very low, because affordable, I think, could mean the moderate, and if we're really trying to address, or if we want moderate to be thrown into the mix, I don't
know. I'd like to see all categories within it.
That's fine, affordable housing.
Okay. Go back to goal number one. I'm a nitpick. Number 10. Actually, the question I have is why we use the word shall as opposed to the word will. Yeah, no, I understand that. I understand that. Right, exactly. I just want to hear it. let's see. Chapter 12, I think you discussed that.
Number 13, I'd like to comment.
Commissioner Schmidt?
Number 13 talks about condo conversion ordinances and how it impacts lower-cost rental housing. How does our condo conversion ordinance work? I know in the county you can only convert, I think, 25% of a number up to 25% of the multifamily residential units that have been built the previous year. The problem is that no one's building multifamily residential units, so you can't make any conversions at all. Is our ordinance works the same?
It's very similar to that. Not off the top of my head, I can't remember the percentage. I think it's higher than 25%, but the number of conversions this year is based on the rental housing production from the year prior.
And so how many conversions have we had?
Since the new ordinance was passed, which was about 2 years ago, I don't believe there's been any, but I don't think anyone's applied either. The condo market was very hot 2003, 2004. It seems like it's kind of come to an abrupt stop. So nobody's actually inquired in the last year and a half about a condo conversion. So I'm not really thinking that the ordinance had the effect. I think the economy had the effect.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But the and what happened at that particular time, the insurance policies with respect to condominiums have changed and made it much easier for people to insure condominiums. And so that's why there was somewhat of a boom on them. But the way these ordinances are written, they just basically put an end to a conversion completely. And I'm a particular person who believes that people are proud to own. You were asking about ownership. I mean, people are proud about ownership, and they take care of their homes. And it makes a big impact on a family to know that this is their home. I mean, the example that I've used before is next door there was a house for rent, and over about a three-year period, there was about 10 families that moved through this household with kids. And I thought about those kids that they didn't know where their home was and what a psychological impact that made on them, not knowing that that was home, and I can go home there every day. It was always changing for them, and how that impacts them, and it does mean a lot. And if you can convert some apartments into condominiums and make them affordable for someone, we should try to promote that. But the ordinance is restrictive, and doesn't do that because of the way that it's written.
Vice Chair Moreno.
I had called Warren on that this afternoon because I had that same thought, and I think he said what had happened in the past is that the conversions kind of a real fever with that, and they were selling at a higher price. Like, so you had rentals that were affordable in terms of the whole thing. You convert something, and then you've only got a small percentage that are affordable, and then the others are not, so you reduce your total number of affordable units quite dramatically. And so
I have a question on 17, if no one else has anything. I guess it's the wording, because we see continue to work, continue to maintain, continue to encourage and support. Is there anything specific, I mean, that goes into these, or what are we currently doing? You know, what are we going to continue?
Well, because this is a general plan amendment, and one of the seven elements of the general plan, if the city does want that guiding language in there, that's why this language is in here, so that you continue to support, you encourage, you work with the housing authority as your guiding goals, policies, and program language. So while it may seem redundant if you're already doing it, you know, kind of what's the point? It's because it's the general plan, it's your guiding document, and that's why we have language like that in there. We could just, I mean, if you don't like
it. Not just that. I don't know what we're doing.
Yeah.
I mean, if we're doing something, wouldn't we state, be more specific, or do we get in too much trouble if we get specific?
Well, in 2005, based on this policy, this is a carryover policy. We did work with Haslow, and we worked together on a 19-unit, very low-income senior project that was built across the street from the post office. And we used this policy as direction for the council then to participate in funding the capital facility fees and some of the permit fees for reductions to make the project more affordable. So those are that's the type of thing we have done, and that's what we would expect to continue to work very closely with Haslow in the future on new projects of that sort.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's all I have on one. Goal number two. Anyone have anything?
I have a question about program two.
Commissioner Schmidt?
More in just general, how have we been using our CDBG funds? You know, you look and I read the public notices. I see a lot of them being used for handicap ramps and so on. Do we use them more for supporting housing?
Most of them have been used more for infrastructure projects, sidewalks, accessibility ramps, that sort of thing. We haven't specifically used them on too many rehabilitation projects of housing units, but we do believe that is a direction we should be going with, not only with the community development block grant money, but also the redevelopment agency money as well. So I think we have two programs that both talk about participating in rehabilitation of units, which we haven't been doing in the past.
Then could we change the language to continue to participate in the program with specific purpose of obtaining loans or grants for housing rehabilitation? I mean, get some more specific language as to what we want to use that money for and try to direct it away from infrastructure.
It says, you know, apply an appropriate amount of the city's annual share of CDBG funds toward rehabilitation of existing housing units. What's appropriate?
We could work on that language. It just allows flexibility and discretion on the part of the city based on a year-by-year analysis of funding availability and what the priorities are for the city. One of the things on infrastructure that's important just to keep in mind is that when you're thinking about higher density housing, just making sure that there is water and sewer service out there, that we do have the extensions, that's costly, and that can be covered for lower income projects under CDBG.
Okay. Is this kind of a language? I'm assuming then the word appropriate is something that isn't going to come back. And, you know, they're going to want something more definitive on that.
I don't think so. I think that would be fine, the language.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that there was a $30,000 set aside of CDBG funds and one of your goals for 14 units in here. It just popped into my head. I remember reading it somewhere where CDBG funds were going to be used to do something with 14 units, and that was repair and rehab.
This is 25 units for rehab on this program. That is not popping out in my head that we had another CDBG program. It's possible that we overlapped.
Find it for you. Where did I see it?
It might have been an analysis of the previous housing element that we had talked about that.
Pardon?
In our review of the previous element, we might have put a number in, which is Section B.
Well, in number one right above that does list CDBG as a funding source with a quantifiable objective of 30.
Right.
No. Here, just a minute. I'll get it.
On page 127 of your package, and the review of the previous element, the table. There was in the previous element, there was a quantified objective for program 413 of 30,000 and 14 very low units per year. It was sort of specific, so we veered away from that for this update.
Okay. So, wiggle room. Okay. Anything more on goal number two?
One, on program number one under policy 2.1, it says, as new projects, code enforcement actions, and other opportunities arise, the city will investigate ways to meet its housing needs through rehab and preservation of existing units. And it says, utilize code enforcement to identify housing maintenance issues and expedite rehabilitation of substandard and deteriorating housing by offering technical assistance to home.
Whatever funding was available, whatever programs were out there to make the repairs and not get into serious issues with code enforcement.
But, you know, why would you just want to talk about offering technical assistance and not work with the property owners to do provide some incentives for that, especially for low and moderate income housing?
We can clarify the language to specifically state work with property owners on available programs through the city. There's not a problem with that, but if you look at policy 4.3, that's where we have the some of the ideas for redevelopment funding, in particular 433 has that rehab program for redevelopment funding. So it was a kind of a combination of things, but it was just working with code enforcement on enforcement issues before they got serious, and so you didn't lose units.
Why don't we just say by offering technical assistance, including funding, to homeowners and occupants?
Sure.
I'm through.
I thought we were through with two before. Okay. All right. Let's see. Goal number three. Pardon? Vice Chair Moreno?
Again, on point four, that we, rather than just specifically saying the solar panels, but, you know, broaden that for what ABA 11 covers. And then under that, I know, just to, again, to point out on page 182, since we're sort of in the same topic, getting rid of that paragraph.
Okay, we have that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else on goal number 3? Goal number 4?
What is the sliding density scale for slope lots?
That's a provision in our zoning ordinance. It's been in there for a number of years, that as the lot becomes steeper, the maximum multifamily density drops down. So I think from 0 to 11%, you can build at the maximum density. Once you go over 11%, it drops down a factor. Once you hit 20%, it drops again. So by the time you hit 25, 30%, you're down to, you know, 4 or 5 units per acre rather than 20 units per acre.
And is that based on known construction costs or something, so that, you know, it costs more to build on a 30-degree slope than it does on a 10-degree slope?
Well, it's been in the ordinance for decades, and my understanding was it was to minimize the overgrading of steep hillsides. So it's basically to direct higher density to flatter land and not allow it on the very steep lots. Because of the way our multifamily zones are and the way Atascadero just lays out, you can have a flat lot next to 30% slope. So the idea is to put the density on the flat part and not on the steeper part of the lot.
Okay.
There was a handout that we had on the table that had that sliding scale, I thought, on it.
It actually does that. And you
made. And to see if there's any way within the language we have in under goal 4 to identify the people that were being discussed through the public comment. Right now, I was just looking at policy 4.12, continue to support local motel voucher programs for temporary displaced or disabled, which is one of the categories that was referenced. But there was also the long-term disablement that was or permanent that was addressed, and then there was also the group of people that were dealing that were recovering into sobriety. So I'm trying to find a good place to stick it in here or to address it. There was a Section 8 discussion earlier under goal 1 policy or program 17, where it talked about the housing authority in Atascadero, the area that you were talking about, Chairperson Jack.
Yes.
And it talks about HUD Section 8 funding source in that. But I'm wondering if there's some somehow of addressing the specific people that were being discussed in the public comment. Does anyone have any suggestions to help me out?
Director Frase?
Maybe just a suggestion. If you really want to be proactive in dealing with this issue, it's obviously going to take some sort of financial participation to do that. So you'd probably better off adding something under policy 4.3, which deals with how we're going to allocate our low-moderate set-aside housing funds. So that would be a spot where maybe we would explore a program to allocate agency funds to specifically deal with disabled persons' housing.
Is it okay to ask the public to help us?
If you wanted to reopen the public comment period and then they could approach the...
I'd like to just get the language right. I didn't write it down when they were talking. I was listening to the conversation. But again, I do know that there was a discussion about... disabled people that were temporarily disabled and then permanently disabled, that because of their income levels was the difficulty they were had. They were SSI.
And that aren't seniors and don't fall into that category, so
right.
They're in that.
And then
no
the other
land.
Comment dealt with, again, people who were undergoing sobriety and trying to bring their lives back up to play, and that they were dealing with Title VIII programs. And again, whether we make specific references or not.
I have no problem with the reopening it, if you'd like.
Yes.
Pearl, would you give us a hand, please? I will.
When I mentioned 100 people, I'm talking about 100 new people a year. This is a slowly moving stream. We'd like to be able to get into housing, get them into housing within a month. But this is not happening. People are staying a year simply because we don't have any place to put them. And we just don't feel comfortable throwing them out.
You had mentioned that and with the permanently disabled or those, you had mentioned that there was basically a doctor's order, you know, keep them inside type mm-hmm. thing. Is that very common?
That's invariable. We don't take somebody without a doctor's letter.
Okay, so the permanently disabled homeless
yeah.
would be a good classification. And the name of your group again was?
Transitional Food and Shelter, Inc.
Transitional Food.
See, there are some people who are permanently disabled who are on SSI. There are others who have no income at all. They may come directly out of a hospital, and then they have like an EOC worker they call it CAPS now, that's trying to get them income. And first they'll get them on general assistance, and then they'll get them an application for SSI, which may pend for a year or more.
Okay. Thank you. The other public comment, could you please come to the microphone?
That was Susan Warren.
And the classification of the people that you...
That I was talking about was people in recovery, and most commonly we refer to sober living environments. And you find those throughout the state where there's a number of people housed and they're usually working, but it's usually for 6 months to maybe a year sometimes just 3 months, but until they can get up and afford to have be able to pay for their own unit.
Okay. So it's a transitional.
But it's, you know, usually 6 months to a year. And good neighbors, because they've got managers there, people that are helping them along that process.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that has any comments? I'll close the... why, certainly. Please state your name.
Pearl Munich. When I said SRO, SRO is defined by a certain number of square feet. But there's also studios, which is a certain number of extra square feet, but they're both one-room apartments. Now, I don't know if it would be possible to classify any area of town as, like, studios only, because hardly anybody builds that sort of housing.
The SRO seems like to be maybe a term that might be applicable. What do you think?
Maybe we... Oops, sorry.
That's quite all right. Go ahead, Commissioner Benz.
Maybe we could modify policy 4.3 just by adding a few words at the end of unsound housing structure, including... housing for the permanently disabled and or
for sober living environment.
No.
Or transitional housing?
I'm trying to think of another word for that. It's
I
I don't want to use alcohol, but for permanently disabled and or chemically dependent.
Substance recovery?
Huh?
Substance recovery?
Yeah, substance recovery. Are those permanently disabled or in substance recovery?
Do we want to refer to the groups? And so that would maybe provide some more specific direction, the Transitional Food and Shelter, Inc., or groups like that. And then maybe, you know, as the that would give direction to staff and to about where to go and who to talk to and what type of facility.
We had two different groups there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was the Sober Living Environments and then Transitional Food and Shelter, Inc.
I believe it was North County Connection.
North County?
Yes.
Okay, North County Connection.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Could staff just make a couple comments real
certainly
quick?
Certainly, go right ahead.
Just keep in mind, Policy 4.3 deals with the allocation of redevelopment funds, money you're going to spend. So it does seem like, obviously, the need for disabled housing would require or make sense that the agency would participate there. Mm-hmm. So I could see specifically targeting them under that program. The sober living type facilities, typically we see those as a residential care use, which is generally allowed in the single family zones. I think the max is 8 unrelated people living in one of those. So you may, if you want to address that, maybe address that just under government barriers, because I don't see that as being something necessarily that needs city financial participation, but I do know there are sometimes NIMBY type issues that can hinder those, and maybe that's better to deal with that in a separate spot. So you may want to consider splitting those into two different sections.
If I can tag on to that too, if you look at program 414, where we talk about SB2, we do talk about transitional housing and allowing that by right and residential. That's an SB2 requirement. So you would hit that there too under SB2 requirements.
I looked at that, but the focus on the emergency shelter seemed to be more of a much more temporary type situation than what was being discussed.
We could clarify language on that second program when we talk about encourage and facilitate homeless shelters and transitional housing.
Residential care facilities that including those for substance recovery.
Well, does it exclude them right now?
I want to emphasize it is where I'm.
Residential care is a definition in your zoning ordinance. Yes. It's very broad and inclusive.
Yes.
So right now, staff already considers sober living, any of these sorts of halfway houses, that sort of thing, all to be under residential care. So it basically says it's people that are independent but need some sort of limited supervision, then it becomes residential care.
So in essence, then, that is covered in here. And the issue with the permanent, the need for the permanent housing, we can talk about making funds available, but what it really seems is there's no place for the, there's no, we can make funds all day long. Wouldn't that be great if Atascadero could make funds all day long? But it seems like there's
every day of the week.
it seems that there's no, even if the money were there, that there's no place. Is sticking the language in there really doing anything, or is there a way to, you know, incentivize or somehow create an environment where more units would become available?
Well, one thing we could do is add a program. Well, we already actually added language to Policy 4.3 about permanently disabled and or substance recovery, and that's in the policy. We could also add a program under that section that would something like work with nonprofits and other organizations to identify funding to address housing needs for extremely low income and totally and permanently disabled. And that would start to get to part of, I think, our conversation in terms of program and very low, extremely low income households, transitional, and some of the items Pearl brought up. We could also add a program to evaluate the housing, the zoning ordinance for SROs, single room occupancies, to encourage and facilitate their use, to make sure they're identified in there as a as a use type. And they are efficiency-type units. They do have their own kitchen. I think the state standard is about 300 square feet. As a tool, flexibility, so if they did come forward, they were actually specifically identified in the zoning ordinance.
You know, sometimes it seems fruitless, and I even joke about it sometimes, but, you know, government's very methodical. There's a malaise to it, but part of the malaise is that you have to get these policies in place, and then once the policies are in place, then some actions and some programs can move on from that, but you have to kind of build this building block and get it going. And so if we get the language in there, then the next steps can be happening, and the people can come and speak specifically and focus in on the programs and say that this was intended for that. And then it just kind of helps prod it along and push it along. So the suggestions that were made by Lisa, I thought were great.
I think it covers all aspects of it.
Absolutely.
So thank you.
Okay. I think we're through with goal number four. Or are there any more comments, questions? Yeah, let's move on to goal number five. Does anyone have any questions? Go ahead. Is there to be anything elaborate? And once it's in place and going, it should be nothing more than some sort of a spreadsheet or something that we can just take a look at it, because when business picks up and we start having more building going on, it will be easier if on a 6-month basis we can look at something and says, okay, we're on track, we're not on track, we need to come up with some program or something to recommend to the city council.
What goal number was that?
This was 5.2 dot with program number 2.
Oh, okay.
I mean, if we're tracking them anyway, this is going to...
That would be very helpful.
I mean, I would personally would find it useful, and it would be actually probably less time compiling the annual, which shouldn't take that much more time. So from a standpoint of a workload issue.
How often do you want to report?
Twice a year. You have all the background, so if there's something I'm missing here, I'm open to.
And provide biannual reports.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I don't have any problems with it.
Semiannual. Okay. Have we captured that?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you. Goal number 6. I think we've already worked on some of that. Is there anything else? Okay, there are no more. I think that concludes our basic discussion.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Director Frase.
Just one thing that you talked about during deliberations but you didn't bring up again or during your questions session was about some sort of amnesty program for second units. And I know that did come up, so I just want to make sure you guys revisited that if you wanted to.
That was back under – we had fee deferrals too. Chuck was it was Commissioner Ward that had to do with second units, an amnesty program. Fees need to come down. So where can we?
Well, if you go back to page 190, you have that program 12, that kind of a bulleted list of things to consider for the second unit program. So you could just add that in there if you wanted to revisit a amnesty program and revised cap fee program.
Commissioner Ward, does that work for you?
Well, there's two ways to revise a fee. One is up and one is down, and I think you should put in there. Again, I said I approach this from a practical point of view. Some language that said you will consider reducing the fees to make an amnesty program workable, because it's not workable with high fees. Good
point. Oh. I can support that language.
So can I.
Yes.
We got it? Thank you. Then the other one was Commissioner Benz. It was under your questions, where fees are a restraint.
Did that get captured under six? It's now number seven?
Know. Yes, it did.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
So let's see if I have any other items here. That covers them. Thank you, Director Frace. Yes, go right ahead, Vice Chair Moreno.
Thank you. When this gets redone, is it possible to see a redlined version? Otherwise, it can all start to look the same.
What we're going to do, we'll do a strike through an underlined version of your recommendation to the City Council, because they like to see what important work you've done. Good.
I just want it for my own records, but that would be wonderful. Thank you. Now, does it come back to us, or we're done here, and then we'll get a copy later, and it goes to the council on the 22nd? Is that the plan?
Yeah. What will happen is we'll make these revisions, create a new staff report, forward that to the City Council. So that will be available online. So that's the best way for the Planning Commission to get a copy of it. And then if the council gives us the correct direction, then we will submit it to the state. We'll go through the 60-day state review. There may be some back and forth on that. At some point, we'll get to a certified element. Then we'll bring that back through for formal adoption.
So the strike-through underlined version will be available online as well? Or that's something?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, the version we'll publish for the City Council staff report will be a strike through and underline.
Okay. Would you mind sending out an email to the commission when that's available?
Yeah. Annette, can you make a note of that?
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
motion.
I'd like to move that we adopt resolution PC 2009-0029, recommending that City Council submit the draft to Tascadero 2007-2014. Housing element to the State Department of Housing and Community Development, including all of the changes as recommended by the Planning Commission this evening.
Second.
A motion by Commissioner Benz, a second by Vice. Okay, the next item on the agenda would be Commissioner comments and reports. Does anyone have anything? Commissioner Schmidt?
Yes, I was happy to see in the paper today a discussion about the lake park and the lake itself and the algae bloom. I did have a question. Is the lake within our redevelopment agency?
No, it's not.
It seems to be a shame, since we've placed such an emphasis on tourism and the lake park itself as a component of helping our community out with tourism, with the zoo, with the Veterans Memorial, with the lake itself, and then the condition of the lakes. It looks like, I don't know if anyone's been out there, it looks like a sewage pond, just horrible color, and it's not inviting for anyone want to visit the lake and enjoy it, because it's not enjoyable at all. And so that's the question about whether it was within the redevelopment agency, then maybe we could get some money from there to help out that body of water out there. Because when it is in nice shape, it's a beautiful component. But at this point in time, it's
we need
horrible.
Rain.
Mr. Chairman?
Commissioner Benz?
I'd like to respond to Commissioner Smith's comment.
Go right ahead.
I do have some background with redevelopment agencies, and it is possible that the redevelopment agency could make a special finding to use some of its funds to help cure that particular problem because it's a health and safety issue in the community. So it is possible, but it's up to the city council to decide whether or not they would do that.
Or the redevelopment agency?
Well, the city council acting as the redevelopment.
Because it definitely, if you want to use the word blight.
But you do have to make a specific finding that says, that gives them the authority to use the funds for it.
Is there any discussion at all amongst staff members at all? I know that, again, today's paper had a little emphasis put on by the city engineer about making some changes and doing some things that hopefully clarify it.
Well, the city has had an ongoing program for a number of years to monitor the water quality. We do periodic maintenance or monitoring of the oxygen levels, and that's what they were talking about in the paper, was doing some additional oxygenation of the water. The underlying issue is we just haven't had enough rain. So there's, even with the RDA, you can't put that much water. There's just not that much water. What we need is it needs a good rain and a good flushing, and they'll be fine again. But that's the basic issue.
Could the city put a straw on the ground at the lake park and fill the lake or keep it full with their own well?
Well, there already is a well up on the north end along, I guess that's Santa Rosa Road. Occasionally we'll use it to supplement. It's my understanding, though, as the water levels get low like it is, we're basically sucking the water back out of the same water table that the lake's sitting on, so it's not doing that much good anymore.
Well, again, it's a beautiful area. It's nice to not have, but at this time of year, it's just awful. And
explore the feasibility of doing something, attempting to. I mean, it's a money issue right now as well as a water issue and that. So, but I think it's something because this does happen on an ongoing basis, and it's what happens when you have a non-spring fed or low-level spring fed, and you have a lot of waterfowl. I lived in Mission Viejo, and we had the same problem. And as you get the defecation in that and the smaller body of water, it becomes more concentrated, becomes more of a health hazard, and actually can provide skin irritations for kids in that when they get into it. So I really think I'd like to see us recommend at some point in time that City Council at least take a look at it and see and explore the possibility of making some changes and including it in the redevelopment.
Yeah, and I'm just kind of wondering out loud, are we stepping on the Park and Recreation Commission's toes, and maybe the wheel should start, this oiling of that wheel maybe should start with them?
I can tell you from having sat on the Parks and Rec Commission that they do not have the funds. We would have a better chance of making a recommendation. We certainly are not in any way trying to step on their turf, so to speak, but it would be an opportunity to assist them, and we could maybe send a letter to Brady Cherry and, for his concurrence with the request kind of thing.
Well, I would like for that to occur. The mechanism is if the director...
Is there a way, Warren, that we can do something like this? I know it's...
Well, your role is to give direction or to make recommendations to City Council.
Yeah.
And you're probably kind of getting beyond the the job description of the Planning Commission if we get too involved in a park type issue. But I definitely would not recommend you make any recommendations to any department heads. That probably wouldn't be a good idea.
Right. Okay. Yeah, and it wasn't not intended to take, but to provide some other funding mechanism that they can do something with the situation. And, okay, we'll deal with it at a council meeting. That's a suggestion that takes it.
We can go to public comment.
Yes, mm-hmm. We will. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good point. It's the Vice Chair Moreno.
I just want to say I went to the lake this Saturday for the concert in the park. It was the first time I'd gone this summer. I'm in my sixth year here now in Atascadero. And I have to say, had I gone to a concert at a lake or a park or anywhere where I used to live, the likelihood of my running into anyone I ever knew was, you know, quite slim. And so my husband and I went with friends of ours.
The second annual Polka Run benefit barbecue for the Veterans Memorial. I'm one of the guys involved with organizing it. We are expecting a lot of motorcycle enthusiasts that are outside the community to come here. It'll be the first time for many of them visiting the city. We're planning for about 650 people. Half will be in the motorcycle benefit Polka Run, which is a 70-mile route through some just great wine country, and about another 300-plus from the city. And I'm inviting everybody that's watching Channel 20 to come out, because it's going to be a great family day. There's going to be barbecue, a band, a great auction, a lot of wonderful stuff, and a chance to see 300 or 400 the most creatively chromed-up motorcycles you've ever seen in your life. And last year's event was a big attraction for young people. So this is truly a family event. It's for a wonderful cause, the Faces of Freedom Veterans Memorial. The funds are going to be used for capital improvements to the memorial, which, by the way, is now owned by the city. So I'd like to invite everybody to come out and enjoy the day. And hopefully the weather will be a lot more favorable than it has been this last week.
I have a question relative to the Polka Run. I heard a rumor that you didn't have to have a motorcycle to participate in the run.
No, that's right. We made a special provision. It was called a Sandy Jack Amendment that would anyone on a skateboard or roller skates that could circumvent the 70-mile route within at least 3 or 4 hours was welcome to do it. And we are going to have, following the last rider, there will be a pickup truck with a trailer that will take care of anybody that sort of ran out of steam, gas, or enthusiasm. And, it's going to be a very safe event, by the way. And all bikes and all motorcycles and cars are welcome.
Thank you, Commissioner Ward. Appreciate it. Now I think it's time for the director's report.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to introduce Mimi Whitney. She's sitting on the far end of the dais here. Mimi is our temporary contract planner. She's going to be helping out while Kelly and Callie are on maternity leave. Kelly's last day was Friday, so she is now on leave. We don't expect her back for a couple months. Callie's on a reduced schedule, so you'll probably see less and less of her, but she's working four-hour days right now. So Mimi has a lot of experience. She's worked for the city of San Jose and the county of Monterey. She's basically going to kind of do everything from senior planner down to working the counter and everything in between, trying to keep things moving for us over the next couple months. So you'll see Mimi at the Planning Commission meetings in the future, and she'll be doing staff reports and presentations and all that sort of thing as well. In terms of And then the tractor supply project down at Dove Creek that came through the Planning Commission a couple months ago or earlier in the year, they have submitted their first phase of plan, so we do have the site grading and retaining walls in plan check right now. We've been talking with the architect. We expect that the architectural plans will come in later this month, so that project is on track and moving forward. That'll conclude my report.
Colony Square, any...
Colony Square, where the center owner and the new theater operator, Galaxy, are still negotiating out their contract. It's our understanding they're making some good progress. We don't have a final deal to report yet, but we are expecting that to be forthcoming.
We're still moving forward.
Everything's moving in the right direction. We're just not there yet.
Outstanding. Thank you very much, Director Frace. And with that, I think we'll adjourn the meeting.